From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
We are determined to enable our people to redeem their lives and livelihoods with dignity. I'm confident with your help and support, and with our efforts, we can make it happen.
Pakistan calls for support from the international community as it struggles to recover from the worst flooding in its history. U.S. Special Envoy Richard Holbrooke says the world cannot foot the entire bill for recovery as the U.S. spends billions on the wars in Iraq, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. We'll speak with Tariq Ali, author of The Obama Syndrome, Surrender at Home, War, and Abroad. Then President Obama says all options are on the table regarding Iran.
We don't think that a war between Israel and Iran or military options would be the ideal way to solve this problem, but we are keeping all our options on the table.
We'll speak with political and legal blogger for Salon.com, Glenn Greenwald. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Nine soldiers with the U.S.-led NATO forces have died in a helicopter crash in Afghanistan, making this the deadliest year for foreign troops since the war began 9 years ago. Few details are available in the crash, but it occurred in southern Afghanistan, where violence has surged in recent months. The deaths push this year's foreign troop toll to at least 529, surpassing last year's record of 521 casualties. The milestone comes as British forces have handed control of one of southern Afghanistan's most violent districts to the United States. Zangin and Helmand province has accounted for nearly a third of British casualties since the 2001 invasion. A Justice Department probe has found the FBI improperly monitored activist groups and individuals between 2001 and 2006. The investigation covered FBI spying on the Thomas Merton Center in Pittsburgh, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, Greenpeace, the Catholic Worker, and a Quaker peace activist. The FBI was found to have opened and extended the monitoring despite lacking grounds to suspect unlawful activity. Some Greenpeace members were placed on a terrorism watch list after agents wrongly designated their nonviolent civil disobedience as acts of terrorism. In one case, FBI Director Robert Mueller was found to have provided Congress with false information in claiming a 2002 Pittsburgh anti-war rally was monitored because of intelligence that persons with links to international terrorism would be present. Investigators say Mueller's false testimony was unintentional because he was wrongly informed. The National Bureau of Economic Research says the U.S. economy officially exited recession in June 2009, even though millions of people remain unemployed today. The NBER says the recession lasted 18 months, the longest since World War II. More than 8 million people have lost their jobs since late 2007. The news comes as President Obama fielded questions about his handling of the economy Monday in an appearance on the business news network CNBC. Speaking before a town hall-style audience, President Obama criticized Republican efforts to maintain the Bush-era tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans.
What the Republicans are proposing is that we, in addition to that, provide tax relief to primarily millionaires and billionaires. It would cost us $700 billion to do it. On average, millionaires would get a check of $100,000. And by the way, I would be helped by this. So I just want to be clear. You know, I'm speaking against my own financial interests. This is it is a irresponsible thing for us to do.
President Obama also took questions from audience members, including a financial executive who said Wall Street has felt vilified by the White House. Obama responded he thinks a large majority of the population, in fact, believes he's been, quote, too soft on Wall Street. An audience member who described herself as a middle-class woman said Obama has failed to deliver on his campaign slogan of change.
I'm one of your middle-class Americans, and quite frankly, I'm exhausted. I'm exhausted of defending you, defending your administration, right, defending the mantle of change that I voted for, right, and deeply disappointed with where we are right now. I've been told that I voted for a man who said he was going to change things in a meaningful way for the middle class. I'm one of those people, and I'm waiting, sir. I'm waiting. I don't feel it yet.
The administrator of the Gulf of Mexico oil spill compensation fund has announced he'll waive a requirement that subtracts cleanup workers' wages from any future claims of damages resulting from the BP spill. Kenneth Feinberg announced the decision Monday, 2 months after the initial policy sparked outrage among Gulf Coast residents. The ruling had applied to anyone involved in the Vessels of Opportunity program, which has employed hundreds of people left out of work because of the spill. The United Nations has opened a round of talks on pledges to reduce poverty under the Millennium Development Goals, or MDGs. Over 100 world leaders are in New York for the sessions, which accompany the annual General Assembly. On Monday, Bolivian President Evo Morales called for ending what he called northern domination of the South.
If we wish to make progress, it is our obligation to reach the Millennium Development Goals. And in order to reach these goals, the South has to stop financing the North. This millennium should see the closure of the open veins of the South that are bleeding towards the North.
President Morales went on to propose the nationalization of natural resources, as well as companies that provide basic services and utilities. He also renewed calls for the creation of a Bank of the South stretching from the Americas to Asia. Outside the United Nations, a group of protesters rallied Monday to call on rich countries to uphold their pledges on combating poverty and funding treatment for HIV/AIDS. In New York's Times Square, Amnesty International's Secretary General Shalil Shetty unveiled a maternal death clock to track maternal mortality during childbirth.
If we don't have a very strong focus on the poorest people on the planet, the women, indigenous people, the people who are excluded and left behind, we are going to find ourselves in the same situation in 2015, where the averages look good, but the people who need these goals the most, the women, the poorest people, are going to be left out.
The editors of a local newspaper in the Mexican town of Ciudad Juarez have issued a rare appeal urging respect for the lives of journalists following the murder of a young reporter last week. The victim, 21-year-old Luis Carlos Santiago Orozco, was the second journalist from the El Diario de Juarez newspaper to be killed in the drug violence that's besieged Mexico. In a front-page editorial addressed to those behind the violence, the editors of El Diario write, quote, "We don't want to see more dead. We don't want to see more wounded, nor do we want to be intimidated. It is impossible for us to do our job under these conditions. Tell us, then, what you expect from us as a newspaper." They continue, "This is not a surrender. This is about a truce with those who have imposed the force of their law in this city so that you will respect the lives of those who dedicate themselves to the job of informing the public." A prominent Australian war correspondent has revealed the news giant CNN refused to air footage of an apparent war crime by U.S. troops in Iraq. In an interview with the Australian network ABC, Michael Ware says he witnessed a U.S. soldier fatally shooting an Iraqi teenager in the back of the head. The boy then lay dying on the ground for 20 minutes. Ware says CNN decided the footage was too graphic for broadcast. He's been unable to release it because CNN owns the tapes. Islamic leaders from across the United States have gathered in New York to discuss growing Islamophobia in the wake of the controversy over the proposed Islamic Cultural Center in Lower Manhattan. Speaking before the Islamic Leadership Council, Nihat Awad of the Council on American-Islamic Relations criticized the campaign against the Park 51 project.
We believe that the entire nation has been engulfed into misunderstandings and misinformation. There has been a campaign against this project that we believe was unfair and unnecessary. We also understand that there are some legitimate concerns and fears that came out of the 9/11 tragedy, which all our leaders here and Muslims nationwide and worldwide have condemned. So it is unfair to associate this building, this community, with 9/11.
And the Senate's expected to vote today on advancing a military spending bill that includes repealing the ban on openly gay service members known as Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Republicans have stalled the measure as part of an effort to maintain the ban. The Senate's also expected to take up a provision that would allow undocumented young people a chance at citizenship called the DREAM Act. Under the measure, immigrant youth could obtain permanent residency with a chance for citizenship, provided they attend college for at least 2 years or enlist in the military. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As Pakistan struggles to recover from the worst flooding in recent history, the battle has now turned to aid and who will foot the bill for reconstructing the flood-ravaged country. Over the weekend, the United Nations launched its largest-ever natural disaster appeal, seeking more than $2 billion for Pakistani flood victims devastated by nearly 2 months of flooding. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called it the worst natural disaster in the UN's 65-year-old history. The UN's new appeal is more than four times the original amount of $460 million sought last month. $2 billion is expected to provide aid for up to 14 million people over a 12-month period. Meanwhile, Richard Holbrooke, the U.S. Special Envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan, says the world cannot pay for the disaster in Pakistan and urged the country's leaders to redouble their efforts to help flood victims and rebuild the damaged areas. The U.S. is spending billions on the wars in Iraq, Pakistan and Afghanistan. At the UN meeting, the World Bank called on Pakistan to take steps to reassure donor countries it will implement economic reforms and is capable of using their funds responsibly and transparently. For more on Pakistan, well, I'm joined now in New York by Tariq Ali. He's a British-Pakistani political commentator, writer, activist and editor of the New Left Review. He's been writing on Pakistan and also on Kashmir in recent months. His latest book that's just out is called The Obama Syndrome, Surrender at Home, War Abroad. We will also talk about that. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Tariq.
Hi, Amy.
Well, let's start with Pakistan and this catastrophe there and who is helping to help the people.
It is the worst disaster we have seen for a very long time. 24 million people homeless. Massive malnutrition, which already existed, now worse. Malaria and cholera raging in the camps, if one can call them that, where people are taking refuge. This should be a global appeal to the entire world to send doctors, to send medicines, to send food, for the United Nations really to move in and take over the rescue effort. That is what needs to be done. Any government, I admit the Pakistani government under Zardari is totally corrupt, and that is putting people off giving money. But there are lots of other organizations at work there which can be given money, and teams of doctors can be sent with medicines. I mean, the Cubans went during the last earthquake, and it was very effective. But, I mean, just remember what happened in this country when the levees burst in New Orleans. People were stunned and shocked by the images that were coming out from New Orleans. Well, this is 100 times worse. And so this country really needs its people. Need all the help they can get. Their tragedy is that they are ruled by a venal and corrupt elite. That's not the fault of the people. And the overwhelming majority of the country is not involved in religious extremism. The images of Pakistan, which we've seen on the screens, just talks about sort of beards and people, you know, picking up guns. The overwhelming majority of the country is not like that, and it really needs help.
Just looking at the latest figures that the United States is spending, not on helping Pakistan, but on war. President Obama signed into legislation, this was 1 month ago, a war funding bill that provided $37 billion more dollars for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Obama signed the bill without public remarks in a low-key Oval Office session. With the new war spending, the total amount of money Congress has allotted for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan has now surpassed $1 trillion.
This is obscene. I mean, on any level, judged by any criteria, moral, political, economic, it is obscene what is taking place and the amount of money being spent on wars. And I mean, I give you a concrete example. A few weeks ago, the city of Jacobabad in the province of Sindh in Pakistan was threatened by the River Indus. 100,000 people were risking their lives, their homes had already gone. The government's health department appealed to the Pakistani Air Force that they needed helicopters to transport people to take medicines. They were told that they couldn't use the nearest Air Force base, the Shahbaz Air Force Base near Jacobabad, because it was occupied by the United States, and the United States were using it to send drones to kill villagers in other parts of the country and would not make that air base available for rescue operations. So the priorities are all upside down. And, you know, this is a president who put out initially a sort of humane face to the world. We're going to be different. It's virtually, it's the same business which goes
on. We have heard that story over and over, the secret base, that not only was it not used to be a place for aid, but that water was diverted so that it flooded areas of hundreds of thousands of people around it so it wouldn't flood the base. But this issue going on, Obama administration has been criticized for sending only 6 helicopters despite a Pakistani request for dozens more. The U.S. has denied the request because helicopters play such a key role in the war in Afghanistan. A senior military official was asked about this by The Washington Post, he said the decision would have had to come from Washington, adding, do the helicopters exist in the region? Yes. Are they available? No. But this goes to a very important issue of national security and the justification for the wars in Iraq and the drone attacks in Pakistan. It's about national security in the United States. It's about going after people who threaten the United States. So this issue of killing in Afghanistan and Pakistan and the amount of money that's used for it versus paying for aid that could well sway so many millions of people to feel much more positively about the United States.
Well, exactly. You know, I mean, on that level, they should have poured in aid to try and help peoples, encourage the rest of the world to send doctors. All this should have been done. They don't think like that, Amy. This war is now become obsessive for the American military political rulers. And Obama, as we know, has in fact ordered more drone attacks on Pakistan in his 2 years in office than Bush did for his previous 8 years. And these drone attacks are largely killing civilians. When you read terrorists destroyed, militants killed, don't believe it. Very unlikely that more than 10% of those people targeted have anything to do with helping the Taliban or whatever they're accused of. It's largely innocent people being killed. And, you know, a year ago or so, when that poor Iranian woman died, Nada, in Tehran, and the entire world wept for her, and a moist-eyed president appeared on the White House lawn. That same day, U.S. drones killed 50 women and children in Pakistan, and there wasn't a mention of it on the news. So their behavior is creating so much anger. So the notion that these wars are going to stop people hating or attacking the United States is just nonsense. It's the exact opposite that's going on.
A Pew poll recently done said 59% of Pakistanis now view the United States as an enemy. And it's interesting that there's this issue of being very hesitant about pouring millions into a corrupt government, the corrupt government of Pakistan, which you believe it is. Mm-hmm. And yet, when it comes to military spending and shoring up the Pakistani government, they don't seem to have the same questions.
No problem at all. And they know perfectly well that quite a lot of the money which goes in to supposedly shore up the military in Pakistan, quite a lot of it is siphoned off by the corrupt rackets within the Pakistani administration. So that's fine. But they will not take any bold initiatives on helping ordinary people who's—I mean, it's the worst situation. I can't even begin to tell you. I've read now 6 detailed reports of what is happening to people in that country, and it's just totally depressing.
You also have the situation inside Pakistan, as I was describing, the repeated stories of the U.S. diverting water from a base so that it wouldn't flood it. True for Pakistani elite as well. The Agence France-Presse is reporting many people suspect powerful Pakistanis are able to manipulate the flow of water by influencing which levees were breached. Outrage has been especially pronounced in Sindh, where hundreds of thousands of people watch floods swamp their fields, destroy their homes as the lands of a federal minister on the opposite side of the Indus remain dry.
This is absolutely true. And this is creating such anger that you have television talk show hosts on some of Pakistan's private channels publicly preaching, calling for revolution. I mean, I was amazed to hear a television chat show host saying, what we need is like something like the French Revolution, he said, to wipe out all these people who've been oppressing our poor and who live in a bubble, who are unaffected. It's the poor who are affected. So not only do they do little to help them, they've actually made their conditions worse by protecting themselves, protecting their privileges. And this is a government which is considered the most friendly government to the United States ever in Pakistani history. They do what the U.S. Embassy tells them to do. And Patterson, sitting in the giant U.S. Embassy in Islamabad, essentially meets politicians, behaves like a viceroy, gives Zardari his orders.
And the power of the Pakistani Taliban, and perhaps that Osama bin Laden himself is in Pakistan, that this feeling of public sentiment really does matter when it comes to how people feel about the United States and Pakistan.
It does. And the, you know, the State Department, Holbrooke, Clinton, and the White House, Obama, should be thinking very hard about this poll. 59% see the U.S. as the enemy. I think it's an underestimate. And the fact that they do cannot be laid on the door of religion or religious extremism, because everyone admits that the religious extremists are under 2% of the population, if that. This is the mainstream of the country, seeing the country wrecked time and time again by rash, irrational U.S. interventions.
We're talking to Tariq Ali, and he has a new book out. When we come back from break, we'll talk about it. It's called The Obama Syndrome: Surrender at Home, War Abroad. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. It's great to be home. Back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Coming up, Glenn Greenwald joins us, usually in Brazil, but here he's in New York. But right now, we're staying with Tariq Ali. He has a new book out. It's called The Obama Syndrome: Surrender at Home, War Abroad. Some might say that's a little harsh.
I know some of his supporters might feel it's a little harsh, but I think that we've had 2 years of him now, Amy, and the contours of this administration are now visible. And essentially, it is a conservative administration which has changed the mood music. So the talk is better, the images of the administration are better, the reasonable looks. But in terms of what they do in foreign policy, we've seen a continuation of the Bush-Cheney policies, and worse in AFPAC, as they call it. And at home, we've seen a total capitulation to the lobbyists, to the corporations. The fact that the healthcare bill was actually drafted by someone who used to be an insurance lobbyist says it all. So it's essentially now a PR operation to get him reelected. But I don't think people are that dumb. I've been speaking to some of his, you know, partisan supporters, and they are disappointed. So the big problem for Obama is that if you do nothing and promise that you would bring about some changes, you will not have people coming out to vote for you again. And building up the Tea Party into this great bogey isn't going to work. It's your own supporters you have to convince to come out and vote for you as they did before. I can't see that happening.
The cover of your book, The Obama Syndrome, Surrender at Home, War Abroad, is a picture of the face, the head of President Obama, and half of it is peeled away to reveal President Bush.
Well, this, you know, I think he's a sort of very brilliant West Coast montage artist, and they're the best. Whenever there's a crisis, they come up with an image which says it all. And I like that image a lot. And I used it very deliberately to show the continuation, that it's not a case that we have a new administration. We do, technically, but it's continuing with many of the old policies in the how it deals with the economy when you have people like Krugman, Joseph Stiglitz, occasionally Frank Rich in the New York Times, Maureen Dowd, these people who were desperate for a Democrat administration, being incredibly critical of some of its things. When you have venerable professors like Gary Wills saying, I'm disappointed, the honeymoon didn't last long with Obama. It lasted much, much longer with Clinton. And one reason for that is that he had raised hopes and was unable to deliver. He turned out to be an apparatchik and a political operator from one of the worst Democrat areas in the country, Chicago. And that's what he behaves like.
Robert Gibbs, the White House press spokesperson, going after the so-called professional left. Your thoughts?
Well, I mean, it's interesting that they are incapable of dealing with the right. With the right, it's conciliation. That's what they feel they have to appeal to. With critics from the left, they tend to be very harsh, as if they are saying to us, you don't know how lucky you are, but why are we lucky? I mean, you know, we judge people not by how they look or what they say, but by what they do. And what Obama has been doing is, you know, to put it mildly, extremely disappointing at home and abroad, it's murderous. On Palestine, on Iran, no changes at all. So one has to spell this out, because if they don't realize that they're doing this, they're going to get more shocks. And Rahm Emanuel refers to people on the liberal left who are critical of Obama, and he uses a bad swear word and then says, effing retards. Well, we'll see who the retards are after the midterms, Amy. That's all I can say.
Surrender at home, war abroad. You were born in Pakistan. You ultimately went to Britain, where we just came from last night. It's been very interesting to see the politics there, but also the devastation of the war, the effects of the wars on the population home in Britain. A report in the paper the other day when we were in London saying that 20,000 veterans are in prison, mainly Iraq, Afghanistan war veterans, for committing violent and sexual crimes. But what about the war abroad and what President Obama is doing? Says he's scaling back Iraq, still about 50,000, actually well more than that, military and you could say paramilitaries with the mercenary armies there, and in Afghanistan, the surge.
Well, I mean, again, let's look at it concretely. Bush had promised exactly the same withdrawal pattern from Iraq. By this time, we will be out. Obama has followed it. They're not going out. What is essentially happening, they're reducing the presence of combat troops and eliminating it in the big cities, and building six huge military bases all over Iraq, in which they'll keep between 50 and 60,000 soldiers ready to act when the need be, just like the British did when they occupied Iraq in the 20s and 30s of the last century. And the British were then driven out by a violent upheaval and revolution in the 50s. So the U.S. is keeping these bases in, A, to control Iraq, and B, as a warning to Iran. And I think there's going to be trouble. The war isn't over at all. We've seen just a few days ago huge explosions in Baghdad and Fallujah. It's a total disaster and a mess. And to present that as somehow mission accomplished part two is a joke. That country's been wrecked, a million Iraqis dead, its social infrastructure destroyed. And in Afghanistan, they're now going from bad to worse. They know, and General Eikenberry knows and says, we cannot win this war militarily. They can't lose it, but they can't win it either. So political solution is the only way out, and that means that they have to have an exit strategy. Obama isn't even talking about that, because that might be construed as a sign of weakness. But by who? The army knows what's going on. They can't stay there forever.
It was quite astounding with the tremendous attention on Terry Jones threatening to burn a Quran, a horrific symbol all over the world, as it would be for any religious book. But at the same time, what was coming out of Afghanistan, a report of a kill team — this is a U.S. kill team — who was taking souvenirs of fingers and other body parts, that getting very little attention in terms of what it means for not just the Muslim community, but for people all over the world.
But, you know, Amy, some of us who are sort of elderly now remember exactly the same things happening in Vietnam during that war, where there were lots of report in those days, publicized much more, I have to say, of U.S. soldiers in Vietnam taking trophies, which were parts of bodies of Vietnamese dead or who they'd killed or tortured
to death. And just this report we read today, Michael Ware, well-known face on CNN, constantly on talking about Iraq, saying when he had this footage of a U.S. soldier killing an Iraqi teen, they did not allow him to run that footage, and CNN owns it, so he can't get it.
It's a disgrace that CNN did that, but that is a sign of how the global media corporations have been reporting the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Self-censorship has been the order of the day. They haven't wanted to offend the U.S. military, in sharp contrast to how the Vietnam War was covered. Well, I remember Morley Safer on CBS News reporting a family's home being destroyed by U.S. Marines, and Safer commenting, "We're fighting for freedom." That sort of stuff is not permitted now. The global corporations don't do it, which is why programs like this are important. But now, if he can't even use the footage that he took, what is that? I mean, how people in that part of the world know exactly what's going on? And it's not the Quran burnings that upset them so much, that they do too, but what is happening to their daily lives with the U.S. and NATO presence. That is what upsets them, and that is the root of the problem.
You know, we were just in London and saw a production that's based on Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States, but it's the People Speak at Laran History Channel, UK, in October 31st, a remarkable production of British people's history. And one of the people who is portrayed there was you, talking about Blair-faced liars. But you have a long history of decades of organizing around global politics in Britain. What about solutions right now? I mean, you have this One World March that's going to be taking place on October 2nd in Washington, D.C., based on jobs, justice, and education. What about the kind of organizing that you feel is the most effective? People say, well, what should Obama do? What should Obama do? He is one person, albeit occupies the most powerful position on earth. But isn't it really about movements pressuring these individuals? That's what makes history.
I agree with you entirely. And I remember saying to lots of activists in the United States during the Obama election campaign, you know, people mobilized by MoveOn.org, et cetera. And I would say to them, fine, you're campaigning for Obama, you want him elected, okay. Good, let's hope he delivers what you hope he's going to deliver. But he's not going to deliver even that if you just elect him and go back home. And I remember arguing for a massive anti-war gathering for the inauguration, which put pressure right from day one on the new administration, saying, congrats, Barack, now out of Baghdad and Iraq, out of Kabul and Afghanistan. From the word go, without that, politicians don't do anything. We wouldn't have won any democratic rights unless people had fought for them. The right of women to vote would never have been got unless it had been suffragettes fighting for it. So that is the lesson, I'm afraid. And, you know, when people tell me in this country, oh, but there's pressure from these kooks on the right, the Tea Party, and this and that, I said, Obama boasts, and his office boasts, that they have 13 million supporters online. Well, what the hell are they doing with them? I mean, why couldn't they mobilize even a tiny proportion of these to come out and give them support? They don't do that. So someone has to do it.
Or they're there, and the media doesn't cover them. When you had one of the Tea Party rallies in Washington, I believe it was right on the anniversary of the war, there were about 500 members of the Tea Party there. There were thousands of people protesting the war. It got almost no coverage, certainly not equal to what happened with the Tea Party.
Exactly. So the exaggerated threat of the Tea Party is played up by the right-wing media, Fox and many others, because they see it as a useful way to hammer the administration. But the administration's inability to take them on in terms of arguments, that is what's worrying me.
Well, Tarek Ali, I want to thank you for being with us. We're going to talk about the Tea Party with Glenn Greenwald. Tarek Ali, the Obama Syndrome, Surrender at Home, War Abroad, is the name of his new book. As we turn, though, first to Tony Benn, a person on your side of the pond, Tarek. The former British cabinet minister and MP, longest-serving MP in the history of the British Labour Party, has served for more than half a century, now president of the Stop the War Coalition at the age of 85. I asked Tony Benn to talk about the former Prime Minister, Tony Blair.
Mr. Blair misled the House of Commons. He told them things which were not true, under instructions from President George W. Bush. And as a result of that, persuaded the House of Commons to vote for the war. One calculation is that over 1 million Iraqis have died as a result of the conflict. And what was achieved by it? Nothing. So I think he will have to live till the day he dies with the knowledge that he was guilty of a war crime and the tragedies, human tragedies that followed from it.
Do you think the former Prime Minister, Tony Blair, should be charged with war crimes?
Well, I'm not in favor of the War Crimes Tribunal idea. I mean, I listened to the judgment in 1945 when I was a student. I heard all the judgments coming out of the Nuremberg trial. But now it's too simple to find one man and hang him. I mean, actually, the responsibility for war is very widely shared. I've been converted by Archbishop Desmond Tutu to the idea of truth and reconciliation. If you bring out the truth, it reconciles people to each other. So I think if there was a tribunal that said war crimes had been committed, I would be in favor of that. But I wouldn't put Mr. Blair on trial.
The hearings that have been held in Britain, we haven't had them in the United States, on the start of the Iraq War.
Yes.
What would you call them?
Well, the Chilcot Inquiry, which is the one's going on at the moment, is a sort of academic study of our relations with Iraq. And I think it was a dodging the real issue, which was it legal to go to war? At the same time, a lot of information has come out of the inquiry, which is obviously true and will clarify the question of war crimes liability. So in that sense, I think it's done some good.
Your thoughts on President Obama today?
Well, I was very much in favor of President Obama because anyone against George W. Bush and also the drama of having a black American candidate and so on. I watched his campaign with interest because he didn't say, I can do this. He said, we can do this. And he built up a campaign of support of people who had confidence in themselves. And I think a lot of the things he's done, the national health care improvements that have been made and the approach to the Muslim world, the approach to Russia about nuclear disarmament would have been good. But on the Afghan war, totally wrong. And I don't know, there's a lot of right-wing forces at work in the United States, the Tea Party group and all the people who are trying to get rid of him. And in a way, politics is becoming a much sharper distinction between right and wrong or left and right. If you hover about in the middle, I think you're likely to get crushed.
What are your thoughts on the Tea Party as you look at it from here in Britain?
Well, I mean, it is an indication of a very deep reserves of extremely right-wing policy and thinking in the United States. And if it were to win support, it would be bad news for everyone in the world, as well as the Americans. But I have great confidence in the American people. I don't think they will do that, but that's the danger. It's a sort of warning. I lived through the 1930s when we had Hitler and Mussolini, and I know when you see something like this happening, it worries you a bit.
Why do you see parallels?
Why what?
How do you see parallels?
Well, the extreme right-wing views tend to be emerge as a sort of innocent and then develop in ways that are not very good.
We're here at a time of the Lib Dem party convention.
That's right.
You have a conservative Lib Dem, liberal Democrat coalition now,
yeah,
with Cameron and Nick Clegg. What do you think of your government today?
Well, the Conservatives didn't win a majority, and they have brought the Liberals into a coalition, and they have offered some Liberal leaders seats in the cabinet and so on. And in that way, they have acquired the Liberal Party. They've done it because their main purpose was to make massive cuts in public expenditure. So now the Liberal Party, which did have, in part, quite a radical record in the past, have sold themselves completely to the Conservatives. And I think the coalition government will not last for all that long, but we shall have to see. The main thing is the cuts are so serious, they're going to affect the living standards of thousands of people who lose their jobs, lose their homes, lose their benefits, lose their pensions. And that is going to create a very powerful mood of resistance in Britain.
What do you think has to happen now?
I think there'll have to be action in which the trade unions and community groups get together and simply decide they won't accept what's proposed.
The former British cabinet minister and MP Tony Benn, longest-serving MP in the history of the British Labour Party. Now he's president of the Stop the War Coalition. I spoke to him in London on Sunday. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, Glenn Greenwald. Stay with us. Take a Stand by Voices of Harlem here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 850 stations on Pacifica, NPR, Low Power FM, college and community radio stations, public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks. Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines in Spanish for any radio station to take us over 250 are. I'm Amy Goodman. World leaders have gathered in New York this week for a series of high-level meetings at the United Nations, among them the Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who's already attracted a range of critics protesting his presence outside the UN building. On Monday, President Obama told a town hall meeting a military attack on Iran would not be the ideal solution to the serious problem of Iran's nuclear program, he said, but that he's not taking that option off the table. For more on how the Obama administration's handling Iran, as well as other matters, for example, here at home, particularly looking at the Tea Party, we're joined by Glenn Greenwald. He's a constitutional law attorney and political legal blogger for Salon.com. Welcome to Democracy Now! Let's start with Iran, and then we'll move here to domestic politics. What about what President Obama said about Ahmadinejad and the nuclear program?
And there's a great irony, because every time President Ahmadinejad comes to the United States, the same media commentary decrees him as some kind of crazy, threatening figure. The same set of two or three comments that he made that are of dubious translation are continuously repeated, much the way that Saddam Hussein, the fear-mongering around him, was based on two or three assertions repeated over and over. And yet what you have is evidence about what real aggression is, which is the President of the United States is always insinuating that we reserve the right at any moment, at any time, at our will, to launch a military attack on Iran, even if they don't attack us. Yesterday, Senator Lindsey Graham was at a luncheon at the American Enterprise Institute and said that we need to start finalizing plans for an attack on Iran that would not just be about striking at their nuclear facilities, but removing the regime as well, though we said we shouldn't do that with ground troops, but only with air and sea strikes, which would entail massive devastation of that country, huge numbers of civilian deaths. The very idea is monstrous. And you see these proposals talked about on an almost daily basis in leading American and obviously Israeli journals as well. So when it comes to who threatens whom and crazy and deranged ideas, it is true that part to this dispute are engaging in those kinds of actions, and sometimes Iran does, but far more often it's not Iran who's doing it.
Let's look here at home at this election year, the midterm elections, and the significance of the Tea Party.
I think the significance principally of the Tea Party for the Democratic Party is that they don't really have much to talk about in terms of why voters and supporters ought to go out and keep the Democrats in power. And so what you see from the Democratic Party is this fixation on the Tea Party as a means of ratcheting up fear levels among Democrats and others in order to encourage them to go to the polls. I mean, every pollster has said that the huge threat to the Democrats maintaining their power is this enthusiasm gap, the fact that Democratic supporters don't perceive any reason to go to the polls. And so in the absence of any reason to give them, all that you hear is a lot of focus on individual candidates like Christine O'Donnell, Sharon Angle, these Tea Party candidates, to try and highlight their extremism, make people afraid of who they are, all as a means of encouraging people who don't see any reason to go vote for the Democrats to do so. And I think that's extremely telling that 2 years into this administration, that's all the Democrats have is a fear campaign.
Talk about Sharon Angle and Harry Reid's chances. He was just here in New York last night at a Democratic fundraiser.
Right. Well, I mean, there was an incident yesterday that really illustrates why anyone has a very difficult time supporting Harry Reid. He was at a fundraiser on the Upper West Side for very wealthy Democratic Party donors, which is where these candidates spend most of their time. And the New York's junior senator, Kirsten Gillibrand, was present. And he was talking about her and introducing her. And he said, and Kirsten Gillibrand is here, or as we refer to her in the Senate, the hottest member of the United States Senate, you know, an absolutely revolting remark, sexist in every single possible way and offensive. And so when you hear things like that, and Harry Reid has been, you know, saying things like this, he came out and said that the Park 51 Community Center ought to move. He said, we don't want any people in Guantanamo anywhere near the United States. And so when you hear this series of remarks from the most powerful Democrat in the Senate, you can show, you know, people all you want, the craziness of Sharon Angle, but it's very difficult to get people to be motivated to go out and care whether or not someone like Harry Reid remains in the Senate.
At the same time, he's battling to overturn Don't Ask, Don't Tell at the Netroots Nation conference. He hugged Dan Choi and said he, you know, promised to give him his ring back when they overturn Don't Ask, Don't Tell, though it's not clear he will beat McCain on this.
Well, it's incredibly cynical. I mean, you see this flurry of activity over the last 4 weeks from President Obama and from Democratic leaders suddenly trying to don once again their progressive masks to convince people that they ought to go to the polls. And they know that Don't Ask, Don't Tell won't be repealed. They know the DREAM Act is not actually going to be enacted. All of these measures that they're talking about to stimulate the economy and create jobs are things that they know won't happen, and that's why they're able to advocate them. You even saw with the cynical appointment of Elizabeth Warren, who probably will do some good being able to create this agency to police Wall Street abuses. Nonetheless, they stayed away from the fight to actually actually appoint her as the director of this agency, so that once the election is over, they can find somebody more pleasing to Wall Street.
Explain what they actually did.
Well, there's one of the best parts about the financial regulation bill, maybe the only truly meaningful part, is the creation of this agency, which is the idea of Professor Elizabeth Warren at Harvard to essentially police the ability of Wall Street to put fine print into mortgage and credit applications that lure the consumer into extremely one-sided and imbalanced transactions that they don't know about because they lack the sophistication. They don't have lawyers to do it. And the idea of the progressive base was that she is the person who ought to be heading this agency because she is genuinely committed to the idea of limiting Wall Street abuses. She's a crusader for economic justice and for protection of consumers, exactly the kind of person that this administration needs but doesn't have in important financial positions. And the problem was progressives are demanding it, but their real constituency, which is Wall Street and business, are horrified by the idea of Elizabeth Warren, and they needed to find some solution because if they didn't nominate her, progressives would be in revolt before the election. And so what they did was they created this hybrid solution where they pretended that they were going to appoint her, even though she has no real authority. She's just an advisor to the president to set up the agency but not to run it. And meanwhile, they're telling Wall Street, oh, don't worry, she's not really going to have any authority. She's not going to be the person who's running it. And it's these kind of symbolic gestures in the last several weeks that I think are almost more offensive as they try and pretend that they are something that for the last 2 years they haven't been.
And Christine O'Donnell, her significance?
Well, I mean, if you were a Martian who came down from to planet Earth in the last week and just turned on television news and watched, you would think that Christine O'Donnell was by far the most powerful person in the world, because especially on stations devoted to maintaining democratic power like MSNBC and other cable shows, it's 24 hours nonstop about Christine O'Donnell, because that way, if you're on one of these stations, you don't have to talk about the things that Tariq Ali was here just talking about what we're doing in Afghanistan and Pakistan, the continuation of Bush-Cheney terrorism policies. You get to talk about Christine O'Donnell and comments she made 15 years ago on some late-night television show as a way of mocking her and deriding her and distracting people's attention from what a failure this administration has been. That's why she serves such an important role. It's a way of manipulating and distracting the voting base.
I wanted to go to another subject you've taken on, and that is Jon Stewart making his announcement that he's going to be holding a protest in Washington to what was a counter what he identified as extremists on both sides. Let's go to a clip.
But there's something still bothering you. As a reasonable, busy person, I'd love to come, John. But I really don't have time to handcraft a message or some signage. Not to worry. That's where we come in. We're going to have signs for you down there if you don't have time. Of course, you can bring your own, but here's a quick one. I disagree with you, but I'm pretty sure you're not Hitler. You may be asking yourself right now, sitting at home, but am I the right type of person to go to this rally? The fact that you would even stop to ask yourself that question, as opposed to just, let's say, jumping up, grabbing the nearest stack of burnable holy books, strapping on a diaper, and just pointing your car towards D.C., that means I think you just might be right for it.
And that was Jon Stewart on The Daily Show. You wrote a piece about this called The Perils of False Equivalencies and Self-Proclaimed Centrism. Glenn Greene.
Right. Well, I was somewhat ambivalent about this rally because, on the one hand, I think everybody agrees that we need more rationality and substantive examination in our political discourse. And so to the extent that he's calling for that, that's a perfectly fine and uncontroversial idea. And as well, he reaches a demographic group, young people who tend to be politically disengaged, and he draws them into the political process, which I think is a very commendable thing to do. And the problem that I had with how it was structured and what it is that he's saying, and he's far more than a comedian. I mean, he's a very influential voice among progressives and in media narratives, is that, for one thing, I don't think the problem with our politics is tone. I think the problem is content. There are all kinds of people who advocate extremely heinous ideas, but do so in a very soft-spoken and civil manner. Bill Kristol comes to mind, John Yoo as well. These are people who can go on and be extremely polite in conversation and have done that on his show. So I think the problem in terms of extremism is not about tone, but about content. And to talk about tone, I think, distracts from the issue. I also think that we don't really have a problem with excess activism in the United States, as he seemed to suggest. We need to stand up for the virtuous people who don't go to rallies. I think going to rallies and being politically engaged and even passionate is actually a virtue and something that ought to be encouraged. But the real problem I had with it is that in order to appear as though he was being even-handed, he didn't depict the extremism as being a problem on the right, which is the reality. These extremist ideas are really quite pervasive on the right. And so what he did was he tried to create an equivalency by saying, well, it's a problem is on the left as well. And he picked out 9/11 truthers and a Code Pink rally and suggested that people who call Bush a war criminal are every bit as inflammatory and extremist and to be condemned as, say, people who say the president was not born in the United States. And that's an extraordinary false equivalency because these extremist ideas are pervasive on the right. People who go to Code Pink rallies are a tiny minority, for better or for worse, among Democrats. But more so, the fact that Bush is a war criminal happens to be true, and there's ample evidence for it, including, as I cited, the report by the four-star general, Antonio Taguba, who is in charge of investigating detainee abuse, who concluded that George Bush and top administration officials committed war crimes. And so I think what he was trying to do was to show how fair-minded he was by condemning both the left and the right. This is a common disease in our media, even though left and right are not equal.
And the competing rally of Stephen Colbert?
Well, that, I think, is actually something that I found encouraging because the rally there is to keep fear alive. And of course, the American right is dependent more than anything else on fear. And as we talked about earlier, Democrats use fear as well to motivate their base. And so the role that fear plays in our political culture and the way in which politicians exploit that, I think, is one of the most central issues. And to the extent this rally is designed to mock that, I think that's a good thing.
Talk about your post-Obama in Wonderland at Salon.com, where you talk about assassinations.
Well, there's this scene in Alice in Wonderland in which the Red Queen is sitting with the king, and Alice is in front of them, and they are condemning one convict after the next, and the king keeps saying, "Call in the accused. Let's have the verdict and then the sentence." And then at one point, the Red Queen says, "No, I don't want it that way. I want first the sentence and then the verdict." And Alice objects, and the queen threatens to execute her. Well, if you look at what the president is doing with presidential assassinations, it's almost exactly the same thing. 8 months ago, we learned that there's a list that President Obama maintains with at least four Americans on it, one of whom is Anwar al-Awlaki, the American-born cleric in Yemen, of individuals who President Obama, with no criminal charges, no trial, no due process, has ordered assassinated to be killed anywhere they were found, far away from a battlefield, no matter what they're doing at the time, on the grounds, the accusation, unproven accusation, that they're involved in terrorism. Well, that's the sentence. The president has imposed the death penalty on these individuals. But 2 weeks ago, it was reported that in the New York Times that the administration is now considering bringing an indictment against al-Awlaki in response to a lawsuit brought on his behalf and other considerations in order to bring him into a court and charge him with a crime, finally, in order to prove that he's guilty. Not in lieu of trying to kill him. They're still trying to kill him. But just in case we don't find him to kill him, at least we want to indict him. And the equivalence, how identical that was so striking. This was essentially Obama saying, "I, the president, hereby impose the death penalty on this American citizen with no trial." And then 8 months later, he says, "Well, now it's time to get around to charging him with a crime. It's sentence first, verdict after," just like the Red Queen in Alice in Wonderland decreed.
Glenn Greenwald, the racial and ethnic exploitation of economic insecurity.
Well, I think, one of the real dangers in terms of political extremism is when there are people who are suffering economically, and we have pervasive economic suffering in the United States. And one of the problems has been is that the Democratic Party has offered people who are truly angry and scared about their futures very few solutions because they've been perceived accurately as standing for public for corporate interest and lobbyists. And so the void that has been left has been filled by these extremists on the right who use traditionally and right now economic, racial, and other forms of culturally divisive tactics in order to exploit this economic anxiety. You see that with Islamophobia. You see that with fear-mongering over immigration. And I think that's when it becomes quite dangerous, when you combine that kind of demagoguery with economic exploitation like the right is doing.
Finally, you're here in New York to participate in an event sponsored by the Brooklyn Law School on the Mavi Marmara, on the Gaza aid flotilla. It's an issue that you have taken on in a big way.
Yeah, it's Wednesday at 6 p.m. It's at Brooklyn Law School. It's open to the public. There's a dinner served with it. And I think, you know, one of the real challenges that we have is to go back and look at how the American media depicted that incident, because the level of propaganda that shaped American discourse around that event, I think, was unlike any other. And
this was a Memorial Day weekend in the United States, but it was when the Israeli commandos opened fire on the Mavi Marmara and killed eight Turks, one American citizen.
Precisely. And if you go back and do a dissection, you know, kind of a postmortem about how the American media behaved and how the American people were misled about that incident while it took place and in the weeks after, I think it's incredibly instructive, and that's what this event is intended to do.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Glenn Greenwald. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Shrifa Dukadu, Steve Martinez. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.